This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Aisha Tajuddin. Welcome to the show that puts the media and the news in the spotlight. Azif is still away on his Raya holiday, so we have Cheryl Kaur, our producer, sitting in for him today instead.
Good morning, Aisha. This week, we'll explore the world of political cartoons and what impact it has on our society today. We'll also discuss if pictures are indeed more powerful than words.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling.
A 13-year-old girl is campaigning to stop child marriages in rural Pakistan. And people in Burma are struggling to get their name on the voting list in the run-up to the November elections.
Hadika Bashir is just a child. 13 years old, but already she is working to save girls from child marriage in rural Pakistan. Child marriage is illegal in Pakistan, but is still widely practiced in the Swat Valley. Hadika's family tried to marry her off when she was just 10, but she refused. Now after school, she goes door to door telling parents not to marry off their children. With the support of her father, she set up a group called Girls United for Human Rights. Mudassar Shah went to meet her in Mingora Swat Valley.
Visiting Hadika Bashir today is a young girl, Shabana. She is with her mother. A white gauze is covering her nose. She tells me the horrific reason why.
My mother-in-law asked my husband to complete his job today, and she left the house. I had my young son with me, and husband asked his sister to take my son to other room. And soon after, he cut my nose. The next morning, my mother-in-law came, and when she checked my nose, she said that it should be cut some more.
The family claims their violence crime was because she didn't do her chores well enough. At first, the police were slow to act. 13-year-old Hadika, along with other rights groups, had to pressure them to even register the case. Her husband is now in jail awaiting trial. Her husband is trying to pressure her for reconciliation. Now Shabana lives with her parents and often visits Hadika, who gives her financial and emotional support. Hadika Bashir was motivated to help others after she was nearly married off when she was just 10.
My grandmother started thinking seriously about my marriage, so I decided to refuse marrying and instead continue my study. I decided to stand against child marriages to stop suffering my peers from the evil practice. I openly told my grandmother that I am not going to marry now and I want to complete my study.
Her grandmother was angry and refused to speak to her for months, but now understands. After school, 3 days a week, Hadika Bashir goes door to door to meet parents in her neighborhood. She focuses on around 1,500 families.
The parents should know that children have some rights too. Therefore, I visit door to door. I'm planning to convince politicians to bring amendments in marriage policy and then implement the law against child marriages and to punish the parents who marry their children in early ages.
Hadika knocks at one door, and a man, older enough to be her father, answers. She politely asks him if he has a young daughter, and he says yes. She gently talks to him and the negative impacts of child marriages. He thanks her for her information. He looks quite surprised to see a young girl doing this.
You know I love you.
I love you too. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Ustabad meri lash.
Hadika also organizes small events with support of her father to try and educate young children about the dark side of child marriages. Today, she is showing a story about a girl who says she wants to die rather than marry at a young age to a group of around 15 children in Mangora. 13-year-old Nusrat Jan is living that nightmare. She away from home to escape a marriage to a 51-year-old man and is now living in a cramped room in her aunt's house.
I would prefer to drink poison than marrying him. I don't know what will happen to me now. I'm ready for death.
Hadika's campaign against marriages like hers is a hard one, and her voice is a lonely one. A UNICEF report from 2014 found that 7% of girls in Pakistan are married while under the age of 15. 14% of girls in Pakistan are married before they are 18. Not far from Hadika village, Sajid Khan is planning to marriage of his 9-year-old son to a 5-year-old girl.
I know the girl is too young to marry my son, and so does my son. But I want to see them married soon. They will spend one night together, and then she can go home to her family until she reaches puberty.
The child bride's father, Wasim Jan, wanted to hold off 5 years, but after a discussion, he agrees.
He did not want to wait that long. He was worried that after 5 years, we will change our minds. In the end, I have accepted his proposal.
13-year-old Hadika hopes her generation will be the last.
I don't think male will bring changes in customs of child marriages. It is time for women to stand up for their rights. And I assure you that the new generation and my group will play a role to bring positive changes and will stop child marriages in the area.
For Isha Calling, I'm Mudassar Shah in Pakistan.
I really love inspiring stories like this. It reminds me of the first time I read about Malala Yousafzai back in 2009 when she was campaigning for girls' education in Pakistan. I'll never forget the day she was shot by the Taliban in a school bus. It left me just speechless. I mean, who shoots 12-year-olds in a school bus? She wasn't a threat. But the extremists consider girls who can read and write right at par with men who have AK-47s. Can you believe that? I mean, now with a Nobel Peace Prize under her belt, she is touring the world, giving speeches and advocating for young girls' right to an education. And Hadika is only 13, let's not forget that, and she's already going door to door, campaigning for girls' rights to have a normal childhood. Being so young and advocating such a change in a conservative society, Samar, it's really courageous. It's just amazing.
It's truly inspiring to see these very eloquent young girls stand up for the rights of female children. But the very fact that this is continuing at this day and age is exasperating. It seems that big farmers who are exposed to urban areas are gradually doing away with child marriages. But it seems concentrated among the poor, landless farmers and labourers who see these girls as a financial burden, so they are married off. Even the clerics who perform these weddings need to be educated on the matter. The practice does not help society progress. It's an archaic practice that needs to be done away, or the cycle will never be broken. Burma will go ahead with an election in November, the first free election in 25 years. The Election Commission says it will announce the actual polling date next month. Among the challenges is getting a full electoral roll that includes voters in camps for internally displaced people and millions of citizens living abroad. Opposition parties claim now the voter list is plagued with errors, incorrect names, dead people on the list, and many legible voters not on it at all. Saw Zin Yi has this report.
50-year-old Un Anmit rides to the Election Commission's office to put his name on the voter list. He was not on the list in 2010 and missed out on voting. He arrives at the office and is told by an official to fill out a form.
In the 2012 by-election, my name wasn't on the voter list, and I had to come here and put it on the list. In the end, I was able to vote. Now again, I have to come and amend the list because my name wasn't on the election roll. The official said it was because I wasn't home when they come around.
He lives alone and works a 10-hour day as a motorbike taxi driver. He's passionate about being able to vote.
Everyone has right to vote. I do not want to lose my chance, so I am here to correct this. If I did see the list, then I wouldn't have known till the election day, and it would have been too late.
Myanmar's semi-democratic government is promising that the November election is going to be free and fair. In a first step, the commission says it's trying to make sure everyone over 18 can vote. And the commission has published the voter list in advance so that everyone can come and check their names. But Nai Lai Tama from the opposition Mon People Party says that's not good enough.
The commission didn't respect voters at all. They are the ones who should have made sure it's right.
The voter list was widely criticized locally and internationally in the 2010 general election and the 2012 by-election. Some dead people were on the voting list, and many names of eligible voters were not on there. Working mother of four, Ma Thin Thin, says she will not have time to check if her name is on the list.
In fact, I do not even know where they publish it. I'm busy with my job and not bothered to go and check it. I voted in the past without knowing much about the election. I see the election didn't bring any change to my life, so I'm not interested in it.
Un Tin Ai is the chairman of the Union of the Election Commission. He says people need to work with them.
If someone didn't come to check their name, it is their fault, not us. In the Constitution, it is clearly states every citizen has a duty to check their voting information. We had problem in 2010 and 2012, but to overcome this problem, we are doing our job and releasing information in advance so that everyone can come and check their names. We expected mistakes in this list. We will get correct list. Isn't that right?
In remote places in the north of the country, people have travelled a day by foot to come and check their names. For Asia Calling, this report was produced by Zor Min Nin in the Mon State.
They've got about 4 months to clean up the electoral roll. We know exactly how hard that can be. That isn't the only problem the Burmese people are faced with. Not all the seats in the parliament are up for grabs. The military-drafted constitution guarantees that unelected military representatives will take up 25% of seats in the junta, and they have a veto over constitutional change.
Democracy, sure, but to be fair, it is the first free vote the Burmese people get, so there are bound to be some hiccups. But what I'm interested to see is what National League for Democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi's move will be. Will she tackle the Rohingya issue, which she has so far remained silent about? Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. After the break, we have a segment on political cartoons where we explore the impact it has on Malaysian society. Are pictures indeed more powerful than words?
Here's a clip from the report.
Cartoon is quite a unique medium. So that's why I'm using cartoon. What we need to understand also, most of people in Malaysia, they don't want to confront the government because it's very risky for them. But if they laugh, it's part of protest. You laugh. You laugh a lot, you know. There are some cartoons when I post on Facebook, and people laugh, ha, 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 so many ha, ha. And then one or two ha, 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 three ha is enough. But for them, this is a protest. The more ha-has mean, the more angry they are.
I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Kaur.
You're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Aisha Tajuddin, and The Week in Review continues. Joining me in the studio is my producer Cheryl Kaur, filling in for Azif Azuddin, who is still away binge-eating Hari Raya cookies. Azif.
I wish I had Hari Raya cookies.
He doesn't share, you know that. We all love cartoons, and many of us have fond memories of growing up reading Archie Comics, Calvin and Hobbes, or my personal favourite, Lat Kampung Boy. Today, cartoons have expanded to more than just a good laugh. A new wave of political cartoons has swept the world. Nowadays, reports on cartoonists who get hurt or incarcerated flood in from all over. Most notable cases include the fatal shooting of Charlie Hebdo cartoonist by extremists in January, and recently an Iranian cartoonist, Athena Farghadani, who is now serving a 12-year jail sentence just over cartoons depicting the Iranian parliament as animals.
Back home, we have cartoonist Zuna, who has had some of his comic books confiscated and banned for allegedly insulting a prominent Malaysian figure. Which makes us wonder, what is the impact of political cartoons today, be it worldwide or nationwide? Can cartoons spark a discussion and lead to movements? Zuna gives us some insight on what it's like to put pen to paper as a political cartoonist.
Cartoon is quite a unique medium. So that's why I'm using cartoon. What we need to understand also, most of people in Malaysia, they don't want to confront the government because it's very risky for them. But if they laugh, it's part of protest. You laugh, you laugh a lot, you know. There are some cartoons when I post on Facebook, and people laugh, ha 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 ha, so many ha ha. And then one or two ha ha, ha three ha is enough. But for them, this is a protest. The more ha ha's mean, the more angry they are.
He doesn't consider himself solely as a political cartoonist. He fancies himself as being a people's cartoonist, who focuses on the people's perspective of what's going on in Malaysia. So, do cartoons have more of an impact than the written word?
They both have different ways of attracting their audience.
That's Professor Mulyadi Mahmud, a lecturer at UITM who has a PhD in cartoon studies. He believes that the impact depends on the consumer, but feels images have more of a significance.
I think cartoon is, since it is visual, you know, in visual form, it has a very instant and strong impact to the readers, yeah, to the public in general, as compared to literature or writing, because you need to write and need to understand the language, yeah, as compared to cartoon. It's very direct, it's very quick, that's why it could actually give a very long-lasting effect on the readers. I think that's the strength of political cartoon. It has to be very precise. It has to be very compact. It has to be very, very direct in that sense, that because the readers don't have a lot of time to digest, you know. They could have like 3 or 4 or 5 seconds, and then by looking at the cartoons, they could actually understand the message being conveyed by the cartoonist. Yeah? So that's why I think visual images could have a stronger impact as compared to literature, yeah.
Then there's the argument that cartoons only give the consumer a fleeting feeling, that it doesn't evoke much of a reflection. Chua Guat Eng, Malaysia's first English-language woman novelist, is of that opinion. She doesn't quite agree with the power of imagery. Instead, she insists long-form words and books induces a more powerful response.
Even with the written word, right, there are people who read and react and people who read and reflect. But if you take cartoons and the written word and to a social critique in writing, then because the sheer length of time it takes to absorb something that is written will cause some reflection. But I was thinking more of also from the writer and the cartoonist's point of view, that we function in different ways. You know, that a cartoonist, his job is to cause a reaction, is to create a reaction. So like C.T. Lim, I think, he said that he wants his cartoonist to go to bed angry and to wake up angry. He wants anger, you know, in the person. And I was saying that a writer, although I may be very angry with certain situations, and I may address it in my novel or short story, the length of time it takes me to write out the story, and function of writing a story is such that I'm the kind of writer, I don't write sort of political polemics, I discuss social issues. Then simply because as a writer I have to project reality as it is, then I see the bigger picture. And so I myself become more reflective. I cannot sustain an anger over months or years, the length of time it takes to write a book. In doing my research and all that, I see a bigger picture. I see different sides of the issue. And then I suppose in that way, I myself am a more reflective creator of a message.
What about the effectiveness of cartoons? Are they compelling enough to spark a conversation in today's political critique rather than just entertain and amuse? Here's the prof again.
Yes, I think it's very effective because, I mean, we could see from some cases or examples like political cartoonists like Zunar and even Lag, Dato' Lag itself, and some other cartoonists, not only in mainstream newspapers but also in alternative papers, you know. I think, take example, Zunar, I guess, Zunar, yeah, because he has been doing a lot of cartoons dealing with socio-political issues, political issues of the country. Eh? And then by highlighting the issues, I mean, he could actually create awareness among the public. What are the things that they should pay attention and they should concern, you know? So the fact that he has a lot of followers, fans, I think that shows how effective his satirical cartoons. I mean, the difference is how the cartoonist approach their subjects. For example, like Lat, I think is a bit more subtle in representing the socio-political criticism as compared to Zunar, because Zunar, I think, is a bit, direct and it's a bit harsh in terms of the approach. So they play their role from, different point of views and different approach.
But what about the limitations of cartoons? We ask Wat Eng if cartoons have certain constraints, as a cartoonist only has one panel to explain a whole story, complete with characters and their nuances.
There is a reactive audience or readership, and there is a reflective. Cartoons tend to evoke in the reader a reaction, and that is their job. But I think a good cartoon makes you reflect. Especially a political cartoon should make you reflect. And later on, after you have seen it, you may laugh and or that you may even get angry and say, yeah, that's right, you know. But later on, you reflect on it and you think, well, yeah. Or else the cartoonist himself may, in the next cartoon, bring another aspect of the same issue using a different person to help you to reflect, to help you see the bigger picture. That, I think, is a social responsibility. But if you are constantly using one person as your target and you keep harping on it, then it becomes like a personal attack. So, I mean, it's difficult to talk without something to illustrate, right? But there you go. That's it. That's how I feel.
She believes social change is achieved more effectively through written word because, in her opinion, no cartoon has sparked such change when compared to writing.
Of course, you know, the written word is only read by the upper levels, you know, the elite, if you like. They are the thinkers. So they would naturally reflect. But because they reflect, because they are the elite, they have more ability to move things within society, their ideas. They can promote the ideas through their own written words and so on, or through their speech and so on. So no cartoon has ever caused a revolution. They have caused riots, which is a reactive thing. A riot is a reactive event. A revolution is a slow, evolving thing, and it takes time. And that is what I mean also in the difference between reactive and reflective, that the written word causes this kind of reflection, that this thinking, you know, about things. You don't see it and then forget it. If you absorb it, you read it, it stays in your mind and you've kind of internalized it, and then it affects you. It changes your life. Cartoon may just affect your opinion of things over time if the same message is hammered away, or the same person, for instance, and this is where I find is my concern with cartoons, is if one person is being made fun of all the time, over time, for the followers of that cartoon, that person becomes a sort of like a scapegoat for everything that is wrong. Whereas with the written word, you do not have this kind of caricature, so it takes longer to absorb, and so changes the way you look at things, I think, you know, and that is what I mean by reflective. You look at things differently, you don't react so much. It does not mean that you do not respond to certain things that are wrong with society, but it's less of a flash in the pan, you know. You actually may be so moved that you will actually do things to make changes to society.
It's important to note that political cartoons are not a new thing. Professor Mulyadi tells us that in Malaysia, these type of cartoons have been around since the 1930s to uplift the spirit of Malay nationalism. In fact, mainstream newspapers published these cartoons both before and after independence. The cartoons then developed according to the political, economical and social development in Malaysia.
It was around 1930. The political cartoons started in newspapers like Wanita Jenaka and then Mutusan Zaman and Majlis. So basically those cartoons during those periods played a very important role in trying to uplifting the spirit of Malay nationalism, and because most of these cartoons were actually published in Malay newspapers, the way they approach the subject is by depicting issues that related to the Malays, like the economic situation, Malay political situation, you know, the coming of the immigrants. You know? So basically cartoons were used as a weapon to strengthen the spirit of nationalism among the Malays. Those are actually the scene from the 30s. During those period, actually, the cartoons are quite critical and very direct. They use caricature, use proverbs, as well as animal imageries. But after independence, I think the policy of the media, as well as the policy of the government, actually influenced the style of cartoons, the style of criticism as well. So in that sense, I think who owned the media, the media ownership, as well as the political policy of the nation, actually influenced the style of cartoons. So that's why, because after independence, after the 50s, you could see that political cartoons are quite subtle in their ways of criticism. And basically, most of the cartoons try to create a sense of a harmonious life among multiracial Malaysia. And then I think there were not so much development in the 60s until up to the middle of the 70s, you know, when Lad started to draw scenes of Malaysian life in straight time in 1975. Only after that we could see more political cartoons, or rather more socio-political cartoons being published in Malaysian newspapers, like not only straight time, but also in Rotusan Malaysia, Mingguan Malaysia, by cartoonists like Nan, and then came Zunar, as well as Zoy, and some other cartoonists like Miki. And in that sense, the cartoons were very much influenced by the policy of the media, and as well as the media ownership, but at the same time observe the rules and regulations that are actually related to the media policy. But I think this situation changed in the late 1990s, when I guess the political situation in Malaysia, with the emergence of new political parties, the issues regarding the constitutional amendment regarding the royal immunity, you know, all of these political events actually influenced the political cartoons in Malaysia. That's why after the 90s, you could see that more political cartoons that are quite critical as well as direct being produced by political cartoonists. And of course, nowadays with the emergence of digital technology and the internet, you could see that many cartoonists are actually doing cartoons on the internet, because I think by doing cartoons on the internet, they have more freedom as compared to doing cartoons for publication like newspaper, because you have to observe the rules and regulations of the who own the media, you know, as compared to the internet, which is, I guess, a bit more free as compared to working for any publisher or any publication company.
Some argue cartoonists in this country lack depth, as only the political cartoonists in the alternative scene seem to have the loudest voice, targeting and highlighting specific individuals. The professor disagrees. He feels that cartoonists, just like writers, have their own styles and ways of expressing their art.
I think cartoonists have ways of expressing things. You know, this is what historian calls the cartoonist armory, you know, because the political cartoonists would use, for example, like caricature, animal imagery, and then proverb, pun or play of words, and then metaphorical scenes, symbols, you know, primary symbol and representational symbolisms, you know. And I don't think that Malaysian political cartoonists lack of them. It's just, I guess, how people perceive it. I think they are actually quite strong. I think if you look from the historical development of Malaysian political cartoons, I think we have a very great tradition of political cartoons in Malaysia. You know, since the 30s, the cartoons, political cartoons have been there, playing the roles of correcting the society, correcting the political situation. So I think they are strong in their own ways, you know, and it really depends how you look at it.
We've had political and social cartoons in the past with layers of symbolism that are subtle in the messages that they are trying to get across. But in this day and age, some cartoons seem as if they may mask an ulterior agenda. Here's Kwat Eng's thoughts.
That's true. I mean, large cartoons, for instance, at least in the early days, the ones that I used to read, you know, they sort of take advantage of certain stereotypes. Like the Indian man with his dhoti and his umbrella, you know, and the fierce woman with the beehive hair and so on, right? Mm-hmm. But there is a gentleness to Lart's humor, shall we say. He's asking you to laugh at this, to recognize these people and then to laugh at them. But there's also a gentle side where you feel that, yeah, well, these are the stereotypes, but basically they're all human. We recognize them as human beings. I think that's the difference. There are some cartoons, of course, that tend to focus more on the way people... Sometimes you wonder, what is the purpose of this cartoon, you know? If it's to be critical of, say, corruption in the country, right? Why is it only one particular person is featured all the time? Surely that person is not the sole corrupt person in the whole country. Or even if they are in some way responsible, they are not the only ones. So then are you talking about corruption in general, or are you talking about this one particular person whom you are focusing on as the sort of vehicle of all that is corrupt in this country? Then there is an unfair personal attack. That's how I feel. When it becomes personal, then I get a bit worried.
Can and do cartoons have a lasting effect, or is it something you just enjoy for the moment? Professor Mulyandi believes the impact of cartoons is significant because they are now part and parcel of a nation's historical and political documentation.
It will, I think. I've been looking at the Western tradition, because there are a lot of centers for study cartoons. You know, people are actually looking at the historical development of certain nation, not only based on facts and figures, but it is also how they could perceive socio-political development from visual images like cartoons. Yeah, cartoons could become not only just merely images, but they are also historical and political documentation that could actually highlight certain issues that actually happened in the development of certain civilization. Yeah.
This morning's show was produced by Cheryl Koh and myself, Aisha Tajuddin.
We hope it's been food for thought, and remember,
The price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This has been The Week in Review. I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Kaur, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.